G'day, it's Daniel Harford. Welcome to the Best of the Breakfast Club on RSN 927. It was jam-packed. Check it out.
Whitey, good morning.
Good morning. Yes, we were talking about reality television yesterday with the SAS series that continued last night. And
what happened last night? Give us an update.
No, I didn't watch it last night. I'm not going to watch it. It makes me feel uncomfortable. Such a very strange concept that people would... I told you, people that volunteer to go on something like that, I just don't understand it, which is fine. It was on in the background at one point last night, and I said, well, if that's going to be watched, I'm going to bed. So that's what I did.
Oh, boy.
And that was it.
Toys out of the cot sort of stuff at home last night, was it?
No, not really. It's just... Yeah, it's just... I don't know. I just don't understand it. Don't understand the concept of why people would do such a thing. I think a model was kicked off the show last night. I hadn't heard, didn't know her, don't know what she does. I've never heard of her name before, but apparently she's gone.
Right, drama. Great drama. Great drama at SAS. Do you know what I did yesterday?
I was thinking about... What's that?
You know what I did yesterday? I took... You know when we have the chat to the early mail crew, we had two trainers on yesterday, and they both had two really good runners. I put them in a multi yesterday, just to have a bit of fun. At Wodonga, because we're Wodonga specialists, and we got an early mail win, which was fantastic. So, the first one gets up. Race one, we get a winner with Yes Sir, and then I was screaming Yes Sir as they passed the post for Chris Ledger, joining Chris Ledger. And then race two, Mick Price and Mick Kent Jr. got race him home for us. I think, hang on a second, we're two from two here. We're half a chance. And then, of course, Pino Party was one of the Price Kent Jr.
Was
our selection. Barrier killed us, I think, in the end. We got third. And then the last one, the Ledgers, again, told us about Smart Design. Couldn't really trust it, but it was the favourite. And it won. I got three legs and a third in my little four-leg multi for $10. Oh, could have turned 10 into 650.
Right.
Didn't happen, of course. Never does. But
no.
It was good fun. It was nice fun having a little bit of a long day interest after you get your first two legs up. You think, whoa, hang on a second, I'm half a chance. I am half
yes.
a chance here.
Yes, didn't quite work in the out. Game.
Didn't quite work out. But well done to the Ledgers for getting us a win on the early mail yesterday. And we just got the wrong Price Kent runner. But that's okay. Dane Swan right. wouldn't have been happy because he was a Pino Party owner, as we found out yesterday.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. Yes. Very good. Very good. Yesterday I was telling you about Moses Enriquez. And
you were.
How we talked about, you know, where he's at and... whether he would potentially be someone that would be looked at as a number six batsman for Australia this summer.
Yep.
He ended up making 167 yesterday. He'd done most of his work the day before with his 130-odd. And then we sort of saw who could potentially play at number six as a 33-year-old. And then we saw a little bit of my man Cameron Green in action, who
is
sort of the future. The future number six, hopefully, for Australia. Now, he still can't bowl, which is an issue, but he can still just play as a batsman at number six, or do you just sort of hold him back? Now, today's a big day for him. He will resume at the crease at about, I think he's about 28, not out, or something like that. Now, the pitch conditions are very batter-friendly, but at the same point, he's got to face Nathan Lyon today. And the ball is starting to spin, and you know, the attack's reasonably strong from New South Wales, particularly with Sean Abbott and Trent Copeland in the attack. But it's just that whole philosophy around, do you go with the guy who can sort of know what he can do, or do you go with the future, particularly going into a test series? Now, at the moment, Matthew Wade and Travis Head are in the top six, so they've got to blast both of those out. I understand that. And Matthew Wade hasn't played the first two Sheffield Shield matches. But I think it was just an interesting philosophical thing about, do you go for the now or do you go for the future?
I imagine out of the two, if we're playing selection games, which isn't fun to do, we always love to do that, for the Australian perspective at the moment, then the only one who's sort of under the pump there would be Matty Wade, would he? Was it Travis Head? Not going anywhere anytime soon, is he? Run out for two yesterday, Trav, by the way. Have had a flat spot. It was run out.
Yeah.
Imagine being run out. Goodness gracious.
It was, it was a direct hit from side on. So it was, He was a bit unlucky. Look, I wonder also, I throw into the mix whether because it's India as opposed to, say, playing the West Indies or Pakistan,
yeah,
does that make an influence on the decision you make, you know, part of that, you know, the whole cycle thing and whatever else, do you pick your best team? And we've had this discussion so many times. Do you pick your best team regardless, or do you still keep an eye on the future? Now, Enriquez averaged 50 with the bat last year. He comes out, makes 167 in his first game. Cameron Green was one. He was the only one to have scored 3 Shield centuries last summer, as a young kid, but unable to bowl because he's injured. And then he's come out and he's got 60 odd in the first game, and now he's looking the goods again yesterday. I just think it's an interesting philosophical thing about rushing guys in, and there's Green and there's Bukowski. Or do you sort of just let them take their time and go with what you know and go with, you know, the best team for the now?
But don't we have this discussion all the time about the Australian team and what it is? Is it a growth development for team, or is it the best possible team at any given time for Australia?
Well, that's right.
That's
right.
The conversation we always end up having. What is it?
Well, it's not a development team. It's the Australian cricket team.
No, I understand that. But there's not much difference statistically in Enriquez and Green. I think it's more a... If you go in the last 12 months, it's more a thing of, well, do you rush the likes of Green and Bukowski in, or do you just let them find their groove, find their level at domestic level, and then when they're in, they actually know their game rather than be in a situation where you're getting them in a little bit too soon. That's all.
Just going through Matthew Wade's numbers of recent times and test level against the New Zealanders at the end of last summer. 22, going backwards, 22, 30 not out, 38, 17 and 12. Of course, he was copying a barrage from Neil Wagner, of course, back in those days. Then there's the test against Pakistan, 38, not out and 60. 117 against England at the Oval in the last Ashes test, 19, 34, 16, 34, 0, 1 and 6. Oh, then we've got 110 and 1. So he made 2 centuries in the Ashes, didn't he?
He had a good Ashes series.
Yeah. So that's maybe Wade's sort of last, how many test matches is that? About 8? Maybe 9 or 10? It's an interesting discussion. We've talked about the level of competition when we were talking about Moses the other day, batting against a largely inexperienced and let's be honest, being quite respectful, unknown Western Australian
attack. Yeah, it wasn't a great attack. No, it wasn't a great attack.
But you put on the other side of the coin, as you say, with Cameron Green, who's 31 not out, going into today's play. You've got Copeland, Abbott, Conway and Lyon. So they're quite well known and quite established Shield players, if not international players. So it's a good challenge for him. Sam, just on Bukowski, I was thinking about him while you were talking. Now, we know that the Vicks are a little bit off playing their first game, but could he come in to bat 6? Or is he, when he comes into the Australian team, if that happens, does he have to bat 4 or 5?
I don't think he has to bat 4 or 5. I think he can bat 6. I think the difference with if you're looking at someone like an Enriquez, a Mitch Marsh, a Cameron Green, if he's fully fit, is the ability to bowl. And I think that in that 6 role, that versatility is obviously very helpful. But, you know, we've seen a number of players historically, just in the last 30 years, that have been a top-order player at state level go up and actually bat at number 6 and then work their way up the order and almost serve their apprenticeship. Greg Blewett did that. Ricky Ponting did that. So, yeah. You know, I think Mike Hussey did that. So I think, although Mike Hussey ended up staying there despite being a top-order player for his state, he made his debut as an opener for Australia but ended up sort of being in that middle order. So I think Bukowski can bat at 6, absolutely. Yeah, interesting. I just thought it was an interesting discussion because Cameron Green came out to bat yesterday. I know I'm biased with him, but I've never seen a player of that age just go out there and just look like he belongs, not only at the level he's playing, but clearly the level above. There's something about him. He's a very, very special talent. And there's been so much focus here in this state on Will Pukowski because of what he's been able to do at such a young age. And he also has a lot of time, which is certainly what Cameron Green has got. But, geez, this Green, I'm telling you, Huff, if you get a chance today, just have a look. from 11 o'clock because he's out there with Sam Whiteman. He's something a bit special.
Righto. Well, it'll be a very familiar voice we'll be listening to on that coverage. Very familiar voice.
Yeah, no, it's not about that. Listen with the sound down. But
I'll be listening. I'll be putting it through speakers around the house.
I just think that, I made the comment that I think he's going to be the best all-rounder since Keith Miller, and he hasn't played a game, which might have been a bit silly, but I just want to emphasise just how good he is. Because a lot of people wouldn't have seen him play. So, anyway.
Do you only have one TV in your house?
No, we have four. And
how many?
We pretty much have one for every room. So it's not, it's something that I get criticised for. We don't need four Foxtel ports. Well, you never know. You've got to be versatile. You've got to keep your options open.
Agile and flexible.
That's right. That is right.
It was a question off the SMS. It wasn't just a random question from me. It was a SMS question. And then Ray says, to your point, Whitey, he's talking to you, I feel they should put more emphasis on young players in form. Australia selectors are reluctant to do this. Labuschagne is a good example. Only got a game because of illness, says Ray. Now, of course, he was in the squad, at least, at that stage, to get a game.
Yeah.
He came in when Steve Smith got hit in the head. Is that what happened?
He did. He was the concussion sub.
Oh, yeah.
And so he got runs straight away, and then he stayed in the team. Usman Khawaja lost his spot, and the rest is history. So, I mean, look, when you've got Labuschagne, you've got Green, you've got Bukowski, you've got... There's your future. There's no question about that. And you know how passionate I am about domestic cricket. There's a lot of talent at Sheffield Shield level at the moment. So Australian cricket's fine. Australian cricket is fine. There's no doubt about that. And Victoria play their first game the day before Derby Day. So Friday week, they finally get to play. They play Tasmania. So
right. It's
been a long, long wait for them in their hotel rooms in South Australia or in Adelaide, but they'll finally get back.
Well, that is good news for them. Very good news. Now, I want to talk to you about something you brought up the other day when we were talking. No, I wasn't even talking with Russell Milton. You were just talking because we have to do that every day, 2.5 hours worth. You talked about this Super League type activity in European football. Now, 37 minutes ago, there was a report on Fox Sports about speculative proposals for a European Premier League, also the EPL, which I don't think is going to stand, comprised of the continent's top clubs and reportedly backed by FIFA, were criticised on yesterday, by La Liga and supporter groups. Apparently, according to a Sky News report, negotiations were nearing conclusion on an 18-team league with end-of-season playoffs, including the likes of Real Madrid, Barcelona, Liverpool, Man U, and Bayern Munich. According to the report, the project would be funded by $6 million of financing from major banks secured on the proceeds from future TV broadcast deals. Each of the participating clubs could receive hundreds of millions of pounds to participate. Now, there is a catch on this. On the surface, it's a relatively exciting sort of conversation, I would think. The best of the best take each other on week in, week out. On the surface, it seems relatively exciting. It does come at a cost, though, because while it is a chance for them to increase their revenue streams and have the best of the best playing each other, it would come at the cost of the Champions League and National Leagues as well. So that element of fighting for a spot in the Champions League, which has been in the UEFA leagues and all that sort of stuff, UEFA tournaments have been one of the real driving forces for the better teams around the world in their various divisions and tables. That would, I imagine, would disappear unless they go with a significant amount of promotion relegation in this European Super League competition, which we haven't got to the finer details of just yet. But it's a bit more advanced than I thought it might have been when you were talking about it the other day. If we got to the point where people are getting outraged about the level of conversation, the detail in the plan to this point.
Yeah, I mean, this has been going on for quite a while. They've been talking about this for a number of years. And, you know, maybe, and we've talked about this a lot about with the coronavirus, maybe these are the times that you have these conversations because it's about finding new ways to for revenue streams, or maybe there's not going to be as much money in the game, so they've got to re-look at how they actually get the best of the best together when it comes to Europe. Because, as you said, there's the Champions League, there's also the Europa League, Maybe you can't have both. I'm not sure. But I think, you know, the problem with the Premier League and the problem with a lot of those leagues in Europe is that because of the fact that there's no salary cap, the best teams always are the best teams. That's just the way it is. So, you know, often if you are supporting Aston Villa or if you're supporting Sheffield United or West Ham United, these sorts of teams, to celebrate a good season, it's to stay in the top flight. And it might be, we might be able to get in the Europa League and finish in the top six or the top eight. But generally speaking, it's the same teams, you know, at the top. Now, that can't be healthy. Aren't you better to have the really rich teams all playing off in the European Super League, and then you have much less predictability when it comes to who's going to win your domestic competition, your English Premier League, for want of a better term, where it will be a lot less predictable, like it is when you have the Championship, the second division, when there is no real feel going into a season as to who is going to be the champion of that, because it's a much more level playing field.
Interesting news. And this has come through because the sentiment from fans would be interesting on the back of this, not, particularly in English football. We're obviously a bit more connected to that you and I are. Heaps more so than you than Spanish or Italian or Portuguese football or whatever it might be, or German football. If you're a club owner or football financier who thinks a global health crisis is the perfect opportunity to rip up and reshape football to suit billionaires, you have no idea how much fans detest your concept, said the Football Supporters Association in England. It's not a bad point. That would be a very, very big discussion being had. What it would do for English football with some of the major teams out of their domestic competition, the English Premier League, would be fascinating as well. Absolutely fascinating, the level of interest and therefore money and broadcast rights and all that sort of stuff. The trickle-down effect would be significant.
Exactly right. And I think there's certainly pros to it, as I've sort of mentioned, but there's also the cons of it. And a lot of that goes down to money. And you kind of feel like almost a test case example, if you like, is the AFL and what that did to the Waffle and what it did to the SANFL. That while those competitions remain, they clearly aren't as strong and as healthy as what they were before the Adelaide Crows and Port Adelaide went into the AFL, and obviously the two Western Australian teams went into were made. So there was there's still a Waffle, but the interest in the Waffle is not nearly as much as it was because the focus is on the AFL. And I think there would be some level of that when it comes to English football.
Oh, can you believe it? The West Coast Fever Grand Final in 2018. They'll go down again. And the moment belongs to the Melbourne Vixens. The one trophy that has eluded them is now theirs.
You betcha, Sue. You betcha it's ours. The Mighty Melbourne Vixens champions on the weekend of Super Netball. I think she might have dropped her mic late there. But anyway, it was a great moment. And it was a brilliant call all through the game in one of the great games of recent years in Super Netball, full stop, let alone a grand final. And Sharon McMahon, an assistant coach with the Mighty Melbourne Vixens, was watching on the couch at home, I imagine, all by herself, throwing things at the TV through the journey of the game. And she joins us on the Breakfast Club this morning. Sherelle, congratulations to you and the girls.
Thank you. Woohoo!
Have you stopped crying?
Yeah, I did cry. That was my first emotion, actually, when the final whistle went. I burst into tears. And I didn't actually throw anything at the TV, but I was throwing lots of words at the TV. And I've got to tell you, it was a really bizarre moment. There's been some bizarre moments across this year in the role that I've held. But probably the most weird was, you know, the excitement and the post-match interviews and celebrations, which go for, you know, 5 or 10 minutes, and then they sign off, and then there you are in your lounge room in Melbourne going, right, now what? So it was a little bit bizarre in that moment, but I couldn't be more excited. And in fact, I think possibly the most emotional I've been in terms of what a team has been able to achieve than I think I ever have.
Why do you reckon that is?
Just because of what they have gone through to be able to achieve this. Like, I think I saw them go through all the different emotions when there was so much uncertainty before we left. I had said my goodbye speech and wished them well, and that was all really emotional. And then that afternoon, they were supposed to be leaving the very next morning, and then that afternoon they were told, oh, actually, you're not going. So then I had to go back into training and do another session with them, which was a little bit weird as well, after I'd done my big goodbye speech. And then they were told they were going the next day, and then it was postponed again. And then actually it was next week, and then suddenly it was tomorrow. It was just the emotion in the girls, even at training, it was something I've never seen before, actually. And then they're in quarantine and what they've dealt with. I just feel like what they've had to contend with has been done extremely well. And so to be able to win in under those circumstances, I think it's very impressive.
It would have been a most unusual feeling.
Yeah. It was a hard watch, even taking out the fact that you're an assistant coach and you're watching it from the couch. Half and I were watching it from our own couches, and it was a hard watch because neither team could get a break. So it was going to go down to the wire. So from the way the game was played, were you more proud of the resilience that was shown, that it was just was more a mental thing than a physical thing in a lot of ways?
Yeah, and they had some great experiences across this season where they've had to dig themselves out of different holes and get things done when it was quite tight. So I think the experiences that they had this year potentially helped them in that situation. But you're right. We literally didn't know who was going to win until there was 7 seconds left on the clock in the final centre pass, which was the Vixen centre pass. Yeah. We were up by two. And, of course, at the moment with the super shot, two points can be shot in one goal in that last couple of minutes. So, you know, they had to execute even that last 7 seconds really well, because with Janelle Fowler, if they got a quick turnover and hoiked it down the court, they could absolutely score in that amount of time. So the game literally came down to the last couple of seconds. And I just think the way they managed it, if anyone saw it watching at home, we got a super rebound off Janelle Fowler, which is not easy because she's 6'5" and inches taller than any of our defenders. And we held possession. I mean, some of the girls say it wasn't necessarily intentionally running the clock down. It was just the pressure they were under. But we drill that, of course, during training to be able to hold possession. And so to be able to execute and basically play keepings off in a way for that period of time without making an error, was really what won them the game.
I must admit, that was the period I got a bit nervous, that last bit where we were trying to hold possession.
Know,
oh, one little error, one little mistake here, and it could all come tumbling down real quick, Sherelle.
Yeah, yeah. And that's exactly why I was thinking the same thing. I'm like, just forward at some point. Let's just keep going forward. But, yeah, and the thing about this grand final, it's not unusual to get, you know, around 20 turnovers in a match because, you know, you've only got 3 seconds. It's quite tight quarters. We're traditionally a lower turnover team. That's a negative stat. So that's a negative turnover stat. So to give the ball back to the opposition. We had, depending on whose stats you look at, we had about 11 for the game. 11 turnovers across an entire grand final that was played under such pressure was incredibly impressive. The Fever only had a couple more than that. So you had to make the most of those opportunities. So when those couple came late, and MJ, Marwi Kamwenda, who we're talking to later, took a great intercept through fantastic discipline and being in the right spot at the right time. And it was those little moments that added up to get the result by just 2 goals in the end.
Now, I'm going to bring something up, but we've still got to be friends after this, all right? We're still going to be friends, all right?
Oh, God, boy.
Who knows where this
goes? Okay, I'm ready.
I believe that one of the features of the grand final was the two-point shot. It added something extra. It added some drama going into half time, where the Fever got the goal to give them some momentum, the two-point goal. And then, obviously, Caitlin Thwaites, who had a few shots at it. We spoke to Caitlin on Monday, and she didn't make them. But then, under real pressure, that two-point shot was really important to give you guys a buffer. And then, obviously, the Fever missed the shot late because they almost needed to get the two-point shot in. I would argue to you, Sherelle, that that added a fantastic extra layer to the way that that grand final was played, and it should remain moving forward in the competition.
Well, I don't agree with your final statement, probably. I feel like I need a little bit more to... I mean, we've seen it play out. I don't dislike it as much as I thought I would. So I'll give you that. I do think it has added some different aspects to the game, which I haven't disliked as much as I thought I would. Each team shot three super shots. So really effectively, each team got three extra points or three extra goals on the scoreboard. I would argue that in a game like that, even when the goals were only worth one goal, that the drama and the excitement would have been there just in the way that many other games across netball's history have been in the final couple of moments.
Yeah, okay. So I'll disagree with that.
It's a pretty good response. It's a pretty good response.
No, it's a good response. It's a good response, but I got a better response back.
He's had time to plan this conversation in his head seven times, Cheryl. You're getting it fresh.
We saw this a couple of times through the season, but one of the things that I liked the most about it was, Sherelle, that defensively, particularly with the Fever, defensively they got put under pressure in that they didn't know whether to defend the 2 points or to defend the shot under the goal. So it put the defense it put them under pressure and they had to think a lot more. And then from an offense point of view, it made you a lot less predictable. So to watch it as a neutral, essentially, to see that it was that forward play and defensive play was varied and was different, added a new complexion on the game, which I think is healthy for the sport. So it's not just the goal under the goal under the post. We had different defensive formations, different offensive formations. That's surely good for the sport, along with the unpredictability of the scoring.
To say that you're a neutral is a little bit disingenuous, I would say. I think you probably know and have thought about it a bit more than some other neutrals, perhaps.
Yeah, I think you're in for a couple of years. You're not stuck in neutral in netball. I think you're invested because of your commitment to the cause, Wadi.
But I will say, what I will say is I agree with that, and it brings different tactics to the game, that's for sure. And I mean, I think what we've seen is that, I mean, both teams shot three to super shots, so it probably doesn't make too much of a difference with that. And I don't know. Fever still had their tall holding shooter. That didn't work. That hasn't won them a premiership for the last couple of years, which I don't think is a bad thing, because I do agree with the fact that I like the longer shots, which some teams use whether there's a super shot in there or not. One of the other arguments, Whitey, on your side is it brings another skill into the game, which is that rebounding
Absolutely.
Skill, which when they're right under the post, there's not as many rebounds and it's more difficult to get it off them. And that rebound was basically, you know, such an exciting thing. And it was a great moment in the match that our defenders were able to manufacture that and get us the win.
Yesterday we caught up with Jed Buse because he wasn't available today. So we caught up with him yesterday, 102 games into his AFL career, getting ready for his first grand final, four prelims to get there. And he joins us on The Breakfast Club. It's a great opportunity. Jed, good morning.
Morning, guys. Thanks for having me.
Good on you, buddy. Great to have you with us. Grand final week. Great to get access to anyone playing. But you're a man that's going to have a fair bit of input in this game, big impact, I reckon, in this game. But just personally, before we get to too much about the game, you've had to see through four prelims to get to a grand final. Do you think it would ever come?
I definitely question it, that's for sure. especially this year, I knew our team was good enough. It's just if we could be consistent enough to get there, which we have. So it's really exciting for us.
Yeah, and you've been more than good enough. You've been one of the standout teams of the year, clearly finishing in top four position. But after that qualifying final loss to Port Adelaide, how did you feel about what it might look like after that?
I didn't really know what to kind of think. It was a game that we thought we had our chances. We played well enough to put ourselves in a position to win. We just couldn't quite convert and get the job done. So it was, but I guess at the same time, the equation for us didn't change. It was still three games, just got to win three and we'll win the flag. So it was a bit frustrating because we thought we played well, but we didn't quite get the biscuit. So we just had to go back and recess and go again, and that's what we did.
How important was the Collingwood game just to, not so much to get the confidence back? Because as you said, against Port Adelaide, you actually played okay, but it was such a brilliant game in a cutthroat final. Does that give you a lot of confidence, not only to be able to obviously get over the line last week against Brisbane, but now going into the grand final as well?
Yeah, definitely. And we knew Collingwood were coming off a really good win, so we thought they'd be up and about. So to put them away pretty comfortably was really good for us boys. And then, yeah, we just carried that across to the Brizzy game, and we're hoping to do it again this week.
So I've asked a lot of questions of Daniel, of Rodney E, Jimmy Bartel, part of our team, about how much emphasis do you put on the last time you played, and even some times before that, because the Tigers have kind of had the wood over you. Is it relevant? Do you reflect much back on particularly the last time you played, or is it a very different set of circumstances going into Saturday?
We'll definitely look at the last time we played them and just work out the areas that we need to improve in. Last time we played them, we did review it, but we kind of moved on pretty quick because we knew we had to for the next game. So I'm guessing that they're going to dig up that review and go through it a bit finer now that we're playing them in the big one. But I think at the same time, it is going to be a different circumstance. We'll have a slightly different team. The big occasion, we're probably in slightly better form. So it is exciting for us.
And your performance at the Gabba, I heard Chris Scott talking about this last week, and I was paying particular attention to your performance on Saturday night against the Brisbane Lions, and the way you move the ball at the Gabba. You're not afraid to use the width because you know that because it's fairly short, you're never too far from a scoring opportunity. Have you really enjoyed playing there, considering it's very different to GMHBA Stadium, which is long and skinny?
Yeah, it is different. It's probably a bit surprising that we're loving it so much, but I think we're getting the ball into those dangerous spots. Like you said, you can get it there a bit quicker and a bit easier from those wide spots because it's a bit shorter. Just getting it into Hawk and Gary Rowan and those guys, Gary Ablett, you got him on the deck. So just getting into those guys and letting them do their work seems to be working for us.
And I know you're a teammate, but there's a lot of storylines from some pretty significant influences in the Geelong Footy Club this week. Gary's obviously saying farewell to the competition and to his AFL career, and to go out with another premiership would be unbelievable, let alone if he can sneak a Norm Smith on top of the resume as well. Danger's looking for a premiership. Tom Hawkins, of course, and Joel Selwood's played in looking for another premiership. When you've got those, particularly Gary, as a young man who's, I imagine, grown up loving the Cats with your old man's involvement, getting this opportunity with one of the all-time greats, do you think about those things, or is it just something you just got to worry about after when hopefully you've got a medal around your neck?
Yeah, it's probably something to worry about after. I mean, just for a split second after the game last week, I was right next to Gary when the siren went, and just hugging him and getting around him was pretty pretty surreal. So, I think we're just going to try and, I guess, focus everything we've got on this game, and then when we finish and hopefully get the win, then we'll look back and really embrace those special moments.
But what about the Cox Plate on Grand Final Day? Well, that's what's happening this Saturday as well at Moonee Valley. Of course, all the action for the 100th edition of the Cox Plate you can catch on RSN 927. The spring ticket will be a feature dedicated coverage on what's happening at Moonee Valley. And you can watch Michael Rodd go around on Master of Wine and the Big One. He's been good enough to join us. Michael, good morning.
Good morning, guys.
Great to have you with us, buddy. How did this ride come about? Because it sort of just popped up out of nowhere, didn't it?
Yeah, well, he ran in the Caulfield Cup last week, and the owners had the choice of either waiting another week, maybe looking at the Melbourne Cup, or putting him in the Cox Plate, and they decided to put him in the Cox Plate, and he got in the field, which is fantastic, and I'm lucky enough to pick up the ride.
So, have you worked him at track work? Have you done much with Master of Wine at all, or is this just a call out of the blue?
No, I've ridden him on two occasions. I rode him first up in the McIvy Diva, and he finished fourth just behind Fierce Impact and Rushing Camelot. And then I rode him the next start in the Turnbull, where he was beaten by Very Elegant. So, he's got some good form lines. You just have to forget his Caulfield Cup run. He just went too keen. Up on the speed. I didn't ride him that day, but you could see that he was being very strong for Craig Williams. So, it's a great result that he's ended up in the plate.
Yeah, and listening to Wayne Hawks yesterday on RSN Central with Gareth Hall, Wayne's quite keen that that Master of Wine will go well on Saturday. I'm interested, Michael, how does it happen? Do you have to get on the front foot, or your manager get on the front foot and say, hey, I'm available if required, or do you just get the phone call out of the blue? How does it all happen behind the scenes for you to get on at the last minute?
Well, when we heard that he was going to be nominated, that's when we got on the front foot. And my manager phoned Wayne, and I spoke to the owner, Rupert Lee, to say that, I'm keen to try and hold on to the ride. And obviously, because I've had experience on the horse previously, and he's got a few little quirks that you need to know, though. I think that put me in front of a few others that I've had experience with him.
And so, Michael, remember we talked to you not long after you returned from overseas, and you're talking about having to sort of do your hard yards to get everyone to remember how good you are as a jockey, and you'd go wherever you needed to go to get the rides. Is it getting better again now? Is it getting easier now to get on the good horses?
It's never easy to get on the good horses. I've found that I'm picking up more rides now since I've been back, but It's hard to pick up rides still in these big Group 1 races. You just got to keep working and show that you're riding well, and then that obviously helps you pick up some more rides.
Is it those relationships too, Michael, that you have to work really hard at? Because I'm assuming you're away in Singapore for 5 years, that would be something that you would have to build up to get those opportunities.
Yeah, definitely. Look, I had to come back. I came back to Victoria and I pretty much started again at the bottom because there's already jockeys here that are riding for these owners, trainers. They've already got their rides set up because they've been with them for years. So I've lost all those contacts and I've had to start again. So, yeah, I've been doing the hard yards, heading out to the bush, riding a lot of horses out that way. I've never really driven that many kilometres before in my life. So it's been very busy, but it's well worth it. But that's the racing industry. You've got to continually prove yourself and to show that you're still up to the standard.
So, do you feel you are? I mean, we're talking about someone like yourself that's won a Cox Plate, won a Derby. I mean, you've won a lot of big races, and were one of the superstars of the sport here in Victoria a decade ago. Do you feel you're just as good a rider, and you just need the opportunities, or is it taken a while to adjust to back to Victorian style of racing? How would you describe your form at the moment?
Yeah, look, I was away for 5 years and riding up in Singapore, which is a bit of a different sort of racing pattern to here in Victoria, and probably not as competitive rider-wise. So when I came back, it did take a little bit of adjusting just to learn to sort of familiarise myself with the horses and the new riders. It's such a good deep pool of jockeys here. It's probably tougher here in Victoria than it would be in a place like Hong Kong, where they get the best of the best from all over the world. We've got so many good riders here at the moment that are actually at the peak of their powers. So you saw Mark Zara on the weekend win the Caulfield Cup. Ben Mellum rode three winners there. Then you've obviously got Damien Oliver and Craig Williams. So it's a really deep pool of riders. So it did take me a bit to adjust, but now I just need the opportunities. I feel I'm riding as good as ever, and I'm really enjoying myself.
What's it like from the personal side of things, Michael? Because I think your family's still up in Queensland, is that right? What's it been like through this period of time and managing what's happening down here in Victoria?
Yeah, that's been the toughest one to adjust to. I've got two daughters, Lila, who's almost five, and Chloe, who turns one on the 5th of November. So it's been hard not being with them, especially now. It's a fun period where they're, my daughter's really come out of her shell, and she's changed so much since I've seen her. I haven't seen them since March. So there's a lot of FaceTime, and that's definitely been the hardest one to adjust to. But, look, there's a lot of people out there doing it just as tough, and, it's certainly not normal circumstances at the moment. So I'm just hoping when things get eased here in Melbourne that I can bring them down here.
Absolutely, yeah, that'd be tough. We've spoken to a lot of athletes this year about the challenges of not being around family throughout this unusual year of the world, let alone of sports. So that's a real challenge. And on Saturday, speaking of challenges, not too many bigger than a Cox Plate. You've obviously done it before, Michael, 12 years ago on Maldivians, a while ago now, but the pressure of a Cox Plate, you talk about Singapore before, is there anything like a Cox Plate over in Singapore in terms of the pressure of the race?
Not really in Singapore, but when you're riding a good horse up there or a horse that's in the market, you're expected to win. Up in Asia, they're very big gamblers, and you know, if you're sent out on a favourite or the stable like the horse you're riding, you're expected to win. So it's a different pressure up there. But like you said, I've won a Caulfield Cup, and I've been placed in it a few times. I've ridden in plenty of them, so I know what's to expect. It's going to be a bit different on Saturday because there's no crowd there, and yeah. You sort of draw from that. So it's going to be quite eerie to be running it without a crowd around you. So that definitely takes away from it. But drawing barrier one on Master Vine definitely makes my job easier.
So do you have to sing horses yourself when you go out to the mounting yard?
Yes, yeah, so all the jockeys are going to go and line up and sing it together. I think Darrell Braithwaite might be there. I'm not sure if he's got an exemption, but he might be there still singing it, which is something that we've all gotten used to.
It's great to have Sharon McMahon a part of the team on a Wednesday morning, and she would have been sitting there on the couch for the grand final of Super Netball on Sunday, watching her girls in the circle do their thing. And the star of the show was the grand final MVP, Mari Kumwenda, Vixen's Premiership player and grand final MVP. And she joins us on the Breakfast Club this morning. Mari, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
We are very well, thank you. How does it feel to be a Premiership player after all these years in the ANZ Championship and Super Netball to be a Premiership player and the MVP?
Yeah, it feels good. And I just wanted to thank all my girls because without them, I couldn't win throughout the match. And yeah, it was exciting to win for Vixens because we have been working hard for this for a long time. So it was exciting for us.
MJ, I know it's Sherelle here. I'm excited to speak to you. I haven't had a chance actually to talk to you yet after the game. So it's great to chat to you. Tell us, you know, you always like to mention your teammates and the girls and how well they did. But you were amazing in that game against the Australian Diamonds goalkeeper. You were outstanding. What did it feel like for you when you were out on court playing against her and doing so well?
Yeah, it's hard every time when we are playing against Blues because she's one of the best players in the world. So I was like preparing late when Simone told me like MJ, you need to be strong, and also you help me about when you get in the court, you need to be very strong. So I was like, today I need to help my team, like because if I don't go strong, their Blues will be like on me every time. So every time we just need to work hard when we are playing against best player in the world.
Yeah, and you were very strong, MJ. I know we spoke about that a lot, and the way you hold in the circle, it was fantastic. And Liz passed the ball into you incredibly well. There was one moment in the game, though, MJ, that I wanted to ask about, and that was that defensive play that you did, the intercept that you took right at towards the end of the game. And it's one of the things that we talk quite a bit about, to be in the right position to be ball side. So if something like that happens, so I was very proud that you had put yourself in the right position then. That must have been exciting to take that intercept.
Yeah, it was excitement because we are running off time. Like it was, I can't remember what time was it. I was just saying like every time we just need to be like working very hard, like defending, like, because if that game was very tough for us, like I was a little bit nervous when I was getting in the court, so it was great to see me like getting intercept because that doesn't happen for any shooter all the time, so it's good.
MJ, I wanted to ask you how nervous you were in the match, or do you get in the zone and you just want the ball in your hands? What was it like, because it was such a close match right from the first whistle to the last?
Yeah, it was, I was very nervous. Like, I was talking to Liz, Liz, I'm so nervous. I don't know how I can get in the court. Yeah, and this is my first time and this is my first experience for me to play in grand final. So I was like, I just need to work hard. If I play the best this game, then if we win, we'll be good for my team.
Absolutely. Now, have you spoken to any of your family back home to tell them what you've just achieved?
No, I haven't. I spoke to my sister, but I haven't spoken to my mom because my mom lives a little bit long way in the village. So maybe my sister, if she can call her, because I always talk when my sister's there. So then I can talk to my mom. Hopefully this weekend, if my sister goes there to see my mom, then I'll talk to my mom. So that would be great.
MJ, you spoke about the village back in Malawi, which is where you came from. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like playing netball when you were a young girl growing up in the village in Malawi? What sort of equipment did you have, the type of ball that you used to play with? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I grew up in the village and I used to walk to go to school where I used to play my my netball. I used to walk 2 hours. So, and I used also, I haven't played with this ball, the one we are playing now, Gribat. So I used to play with a plastic bag, remolded by fire. And also I used to play on the dirty court, like dusty court. And the ring we use, from the car, and the goalpost I used to catch something from the tree. So it was a little bit different. It was different, not lucky like these girls here in Australia, because they're very lucky. They don't know how lucky they are. So that's how I was playing.
So how did it get to the be then that you ended up in Australia, MJ? I mean, you're playing with plastic bags melted and tied with string as balls and tyres and tyre rims as your goals on a tree, basically, on big branches. How did you end up catching the attention of someone in Australia? How does this happen?
Oh, because I was playing for my Malawi team, youth netball, in 2009.
Yep.
One of the coaches for Malawi Queens is the one who spotted me in the village to play because I was growing tall. Because, oh, this girl can play netball. But I didn't have any idea about netball because when you grow up without TV, you don't have any idea. Because in the video, you just play. So the coach for Malawi is the one who spotted me in the village. That, oh, this girl is tall. Come in the city so you can pray for us. So I was like, oh, I was a little bit nervous. Because, I used in the village. It's different when you are different. It's different when you are living, when you grow up in the village and going to the city. I was like, oh, maybe I should go. And my mom was like, oh, you need to go. Maybe one day you change me. And I was like, oh, I'm nervous. I went my first time. Then I go back again. I'm like, oh no, I can't stay in the city. Then the coach come and get me again. Then I was like, okay, maybe I need to go. Maybe this will be good for my future, because in the village girls get married 15 years, and now all my friends, they are married now. We have got 5 kids, 6 kids. So yeah, it was lucky for me to get spotted in the city. Then I play for Malawi Youth Netball Champion. That's where one of the lady from Flagstone, she's the one who spotted me there in Cook Island. Yeah. So my first time, I couldn't come because I didn't have phone. In the village, it was hard to communicate. So one of my cousins, she's the one who helped me to come over here in Australia. But my first time, life was tough because language was tough for me, and also food was different for me. Weather, yeah. I've never seen this weather. So, yeah. It was a little bit different for me. But lucky now, I'm playing for Vixens. Yeah, was my dream team, to play for Vixens.
And you're a premiership champion and MVP in the grand final. It's amazing. And 10 years ago, you come across as a 21-year-old or so from Malawi, and you find yourself in Melbourne, and 10 years later, this is where you are. Can you believe how different your life is 10 years down the track?
Yeah. Oh, my God. Sometimes I'm dreaming. And also because
because also the money I get from netball and they help my family a lot because now I build my mom's house and also I help some of the girls in Malawi school fees. Yeah, because most of the girls in the village are very poor. So the money I get from netball, I help them and netball has changed my life a lot.
Well, magnificent. Well, you've changed a few lives around here as well, the impact you've had on a lot of people from what I know, MJ. So you should be very proud of what you've been able to achieve. And before I let you go, is it true that on Sunday night, for the first time, you may have had your first alcoholic drink?
Yes. And I guess after the next day, I'm like, girls, how do you do this? Yeah, that was my first time, and I get sick. I was like, oh, no.
Let's get into the RSN Legends Series today, and we go to one of the all-time greats, as far as I'm concerned. Pick number 31 in the 1997 National Draft, went on to play 322 games with the Brisbane Lions, kicked 171 goals, played for Australia a couple of times, was a three-time premiership player with the Lions, a Brownlow medalist, a Norm Smith medalist, a three-time All-Australian, of course, recently inducted this year, in fact, into the Australian Football Hall of Fame. There's only one man that fits that bill. Simon Black joins us on The Breakfast Club. Good morning, Blackie.
Good morning, Half. Good morning, Adam. Nice to meet you guys.
Great to have you with us. Of course, on top of all of that, I'm not sure where it sits in your CV rankings, but you're the 2020 AFL Grand Final Cup Ambassador, travelling with the Cup all over the country. How's that been?
Yeah, it's been great. Thanks, mate. I really enjoyed it. To be able to take the Cup, we started up in Cairns, and to be able to take it around a lot of the communities and, you know, we're a non-traditional AFL town, state in Queensland, as you well know. So to be able to share the cup and people to be able to feel it and get a sense of it and have a photo with it and all that sort of thing has been fantastic. And, yeah, to be a small part of it, it's been a great journey. And, yeah, I've loved every minute of it so far. And the momentum in town's obviously building the groundswell of energy and excitement, albeit the Lions aren't obviously going to be there. But even so, it's been a fantastic week and it's going to be a great few days ahead.
Yeah, no doubt it would have been topped off had Brisbane been able to win on the weekend against the Cats, not to be. But just on the impact that the Premiership Cup has had, and when you've taken it to the schools and the public places and seen all the people, and we know how important Queensland's been for footy this year with basically making sure the season went ahead, which is unbelievable and quite remarkable, really. The impact of footy and that trophy in the last little while, have you been surprised by how people have responded?
Yeah, I have. It's almost, you know, like the Holy Grail. It really is. Everyone sees it and can't believe it's the real cup. And, yeah, to see that, I guess, particularly in North Queensland, you know, they've never really seen the cup like that. So to be able to, yeah, actually physically hold it and have a photo with it and all that sort of thing, and people, you know, surprised at the weight of it and all that kind of thing, it's been really nice. I've seen the game grow a lot in the 20-odd years that I've been in Queensland. And we've had some, you know, tough periods with the Lions in that time, obviously. But, yeah, this year and all the football here and obviously the showpiece this weekend, it's, you know, it's back page in the paper, it's leading the sports headline on telly and just the general chit-chat in the community. It's really exploded. So it's a real massive shot in the arm for our game up here. And it's obviously, yeah, great to be a small part of it.
The fairy tale, obviously, would have been Brisbane to at least make the grand final, to make grand final week even bigger. But do you think, Simon, despite that Queensland's really going to benefit, or AFL is really going to benefit from what's happened this year?
Yeah, look, I do, Adam. I mean, I guess it's a generational thing, the shift in following up here. And, you know, I think a lot of mums and dads with young children, you know, have been going to games and, you know, kids talk about it more when they go to school and so forth and with their friends. And the participation numbers have exploded in Queensland. The viewership on TV audience has gone up 35%. I heard Gillan McLaughlin talking the other day. So it's really, it's in our face so much more. And also up here, something that's been pretty evident is that the old saying, if you get the mums, you get the kids. And I know there's been some pretty serious injuries with kids in schools, neck injuries and the rugby codes. And I think that's really helped the growth of our participation in the youth in Queensland. So, yeah, all in all, there's been lots of different, I guess, reasons for the growth of our game. But you're in a good position, and it is. It's invaluable what's happened in Queensland for footy this year, no doubt.
And if we talk about you, Black, in your time in footy, you had an amazing career, a storied career with the Brisbane Lions through an ultimately very, very successful era in that early 2000s period. But going back a little bit, was athletics ever a chance with you? Because my understanding is you're a great 800, 1500 metre runner as a teenager. Was there a chance to move into that, or was it always footy for you?
No, I don't think I was ever that top-notch level in that, mate. I was competitive, I guess, but I represented WA a couple of times and things, but I don't think it would have been a career. Footy was it. I didn't really think that was going to sort of work out until my late teens too. It was certainly footy.
Righto. Okay. Well, it worked out pretty well. And you had the back injury that was talked about during your draft year, I remember, as well. Did that ever look like it might hold you back?
Yeah, I didn't play sports for about 12 or 18 months when I was 16 and 17, age bracket. And yeah, I guess as a young aspiring kid, it was a really, really tough time. I didn't know how long timeline-wise I was going to be out of sports for. And I'd see my friends represent WA in the state 16s and go off to national carnival and all that sort of thing. And for me, I was a little frustrated just a bit concerned that, to be honest, I wouldn't play sport again because my back was, I was in a lot of pain with the complaint. So it was something throughout my football career I had to sort of manage and be on the physio table a lot to be really freed out through my lower back and hips and so forth. But that was a little challenging period, but once I came through it, I guess it sort of drove me a bit too to have a real crack at it.
To move from WA to Queensland, it's a massive move. And doing that at such a young age, what was that like for you? How daunting was it? How difficult was it, I guess, particularly in the early stages for you?
Yeah, it was great. It was the best thing for me. I mean, I was pretty well looked after at home, Adam. So to get out and to go and just stand on my own 2 feet and get lost in a new city and learn to cook and clean and, get home from training at 9 o'clock at night and have to cook your own dinner and all those sort of things that... It comes as being a bachelor at 18 and a professional footballer, I guess. It was great, mate. It was fantastic. And it was hard. I mean, I remember my first year just being out of my comfort zone so much and talk about, I guess, developing as a young person. Yeah, my first year, like a lot of guys, I guess, and they come into the system and move into the state, it's everything's so new and foreign and you certainly grow so much. And I look back with great, fond memories from my first year and all the mess ups that I did along the way as well.
Well, your first 10 games were fascinating because you had three coaches in your first 10 games. John Northey was coaching first year, then Roger Merritt took over at the end of the season, then Lee Matthews comes in round one in 1999, and you've had three coaches in 10 games. Your head must have been spinning.
Yeah, it was half. I mean, I was lucky John Northey gave me an opportunity to play AFL footy at the start of my first year, and I really wasn't ready for it. I mean, I'd only played two games off the bench for East Fremantle the year before, and I got the call up, and honestly, I thought I was going to get snapped in half out there. I was that skinny, skinnier than a point post. So I was so sorry, but so we got a crack, and Luke Power and I, we played a few games our first year, and then all of a sudden, John Norley got dismissed after about 10 games, lost his job, and then Roger Merritt took over, and it was a pretty tumultuous year for the club. But you know what it's like when you're young and it's all new. You don't really realise what's going on. You're just enjoying the fact that you've played a couple of games. So, and then obviously Lee came along and things moved fairly quickly. I mean, we went from the wooden spoon in 98 and Lee's first year in 99 to making the prelim final. So a quick spike, and that was pretty amazing to be a part of too.
Oh, that was what I was going to ask you, Simon. I mean, it turned around so quickly. So you go there to a club that's struggling, and said from one side of the country to the other. How quickly did you realise that? This is going to turn around really quickly. Did it happen early, or was it something that you sort of thought it's kind of stumbled across it? That hang on a sec, this is going to come together really quickly.
Well, yeah, I mean, Lee walked in. He's standing within the game, and he made some changes straight away. I must say, in 98, we had a lot of injuries to the older mature players as well, and I guess that's why guys like myself got an opportunity before we were probably ready. So, 99 were really healthy. He made some good strategic moves. He put Justin Lepage and Jason Ackermanis to the back line, and they were both all Australians that year, and but they previously both played in the forward line, and Vossie came back, didn't he, from his broken leg in 99, and
I guess he's somewhat healthy, but I think he was an All-Australian that year with a steel rod between his ankle and his knee joint, which is quite incredible, actually. We sort of were healthy. And Lee, I guess when I talk about Lee, the confidence that he gave us as a playing group, you know, his message when he would say something, the fact that, you know, he'd lived it and been there and, you know, man he was, gave us enormous confidence. And I think that really flowed on to the big moments in the big, you know, grand finals throughout our time. And we're just so fortunate to have him as our coach, weren't we?
No doubt.
Yes.
No doubt.
But I think they were very fortunate to have you as well, Simon, because best and fairest in two of the premierships and also a Norm Smith medal, which meant you're the best on the field in a grand final. How proud of you are you of that?
I'm obviously proud. It's never lost to me that, I think Lachie Neal said it the other night, to win some individual awards, you've got to be part of a really good side. To win a Brownlow, you've got to be, you know, thereabouts to get a lot of the votes and so forth. But, you know, yeah, so I was part of a fantastic club, clearly, in a great year. And I was a beneficiary of some individual awards on the back of that. And, you know, I understood I could play the game at a reasonable level if things all went my way and I worked hard and all those sort of things. I was always a bit of a self-doubter, to be honest. I always sort of lived with that bit of fear of failure, which I guess some athletes live with. And so I never really enjoyed the lead-up to games. I was always sort of sick in it. You always sort of had to drag my mind out of sort of the negativity and doubt space a fair bit. But, I love the game so much. I love sort of testing myself and, I guess as a young player, there comes a time where you feel like you can sort of belong, I guess, out there, or you should belong. And I remember that sort of my third or fourth year, and that gave me a lot of confidence to sort of, I guess, just to feel like I belong out there, and I really enjoyed it a bit more.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.